Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners, to amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients. SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link. On this episode, we sit down with Dan Rubin, who was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma in 2017 and has since navigated many, many different types of therapies to manage his diagnosis. Dan's unique record-keeping system, which we dive into throughout the episode, along with the incredible support of his wife, Catherine, has allowed Dan to navigate his care and advocate for himself throughout the years. Dan has had to make numerous informed decisions about the best courses of action for his treatments. And from clinical trials to taking a more palliative approach, Dan has so much experience to share with the sarcoma community. As a 7-time marathoner, we talk about how exercise has continued to support Dan through his diagnosis and how he's maintained his positive mindset 95 to 98% of the time. Dan, we are so appreciative of the insights you've shared. Thank you for your vulnerability. Listeners, let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories, and welcome back if you are a regular listener. I'm Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Brandy, and I'm your other host.
And today we're here with Dan Rubin. Dan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Dan Rubin. I am now 64 years old, looking forward to turning 65, father of 3 children, happily married for almost 40 years to the same woman who is also my pediatric oncology helper nurse. And I am lucky enough to be the grandfather of a delightful 8-month-old girl.
Aw, congratulations on the new family member. We're so excited to have you here, Dan. And what a great introduction. Today we're here to talk about your sarcoma story. Let's start with how you got here. How did you get here to have a sarcoma story to share?
Well, until I was 57, I considered myself the healthiest person that I knew. And my friends considered myself the healthiest person that I knew. I had missed about 3 days of work since I left college. I always did sports at a very high level when I was younger. I continued running into my 50s. Once the kids left the house, I worked hard to restart the marathon running. Qualified and ran the Boston Marathon in 2016. I am a low-carb eater. For 15 years, I exercised a lot, and one day, my left arm was bugging me, and I couldn't get rid of the kind of knot in it. So after a few weeks, I went to the local orthopedist, who did a quick x-ray, said, oh, you just kind of have a knot there. We'll just give you a steroid shot. Don't worry about it. And pain left. And 6 months later, in about the same spot, I saw a little bump. I felt great. I was running. At some point in time, a few months later, I started to swim more. And I go, my shoulder's kind of bothering me. And I said, well, that's because I'm 57. I went to a new general practitioner. I asked him about it. He goes, it's harmless. I went back to the orthopedic again, and I got a third doctor who looked at it and said, it's harmless. And he said, if you ever have a lot of shoulder pain, come back and we'll just drain it. So a few months later, I was on, you know, a 10-mile run in the mountains. And I thought, gosh, my shoulder hurts a little bit. I went back in to now the first doctor that I had seen who said, I'll just drain it. You'll be at work in 20 minutes. And he went to drain it and he couldn't drain it. And I said, is that bad? No. It's just a ganglion cyst. We're going to do a quick MRI. I'm just going to see how big it is. And that will determine, you know, what's the procedure that I need to take it out. So I get the MRI done and I happened to bring my wife. When he looked at the MRI, he looked at my wife and he said, who do you know at a cancer center that was across the street? And my wife says, well, I work there. And we decided in a hurry what to do. And so we get all these tests. It's 2 weeks of kind of nervousness over what's going on. We get the tests done and we can't get an appointment at this major cancer center. You know, we don't yet know that it's a sarcoma. We're not sure that it's a cancer. But it looks kind of like there's blood involvement. And we have an appointment 2 months out with a orthopedic oncologist. So I don't have my results back. And I go to get on my Peloton. This is 2017. I was not a bike rider. So I knew nothing about bike shoes. I put on my bike shoes. I realized, gosh, I forgot my phone. I walk upstairs, I get my phone, I walk downstairs, and bike riders know you're not supposed to walk downstairs with bike shoes because you can slip and fall. So I slipped and fell and broke my collarbone.
Oh, girl, no.
Right on top of the bad news, because of this, they raced me in to the major cancer center, which was effectively across the street. And 4 days later, I had a biopsy from the most wonderful orthopedic oncology surgeon who said, well, this is clearly some type of cancer. The fracture was clearly pathological. The tumor had eaten through the bone. That's what the biopsy is from this. And he called me a week later and he says, you have Ewing sarcoma. Now, this was a big surprise because Ewing sarcoma is A, almost always found in young males and their teens and 20s. As my friends say, Dan, the jokes write themselves about your behavior and demeanor in your 50s. And B, my wife, before she was a coordinator on the maternity unit, was a pediatric oncology nurse.
Right. This is not the first time you've heard of a sarcoma because your wife is quite familiar with it. You already know what a sarcoma is, but the fact that you have a sarcoma is very surprising, it sounds.
Well, and the fact that it's Ewing's, right? I have now met a lot of people who have sarcomas, but they're typically statistically more likely to be found in adults as opposed to kids. So my wife didn't believe it. She called the doctor she used to work with at this major medical center, who was still working. He was a pediatric oncologist.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there's no way your 57-year-old husband has Ewing's. It just seems impossible. And I'm going down to the pathology lab to see what's going on. And he called her back that night and said, it's Ewing's, it's definitively Ewing's, and try to get on the pediatric protocol. A few days later, we met our beloved oncologist. We are still working with her all of these years later. She laid out what the treatment plan was. It was 14 rounds in the hospital of the normal first line for Ewing's. And my poor wife just went white. I was like, this is exactly what she gave to her pediatric patients, you know, those years ago. And they said, the goal is to try to do this every 2 weeks. For adults, we used to do it every 3 weeks, but we seem to have better results if we can do it every 2 weeks for the adults. So they laid out this plan, and I said, well, when do I start? And you said, you start on Tuesday, right? Next Tuesday, I go, you know, that's like 5 days from now. You know, can I have an extra week, get my life in order? And she said, no, you need to start immediately. And she looked at me and she said, and you need to fatten up. The hardest thing for my wife and I after being diagnosed was, how do you tell the children? And what do you tell the children? And there was this weird gap from when they kind of knew something was wrong. I clearly fell and broke my collarbone as we were trying to figure out the diagnosis. And the advice given to us was, don't tell them much until after you know what the diagnosis is and you know what the treatment will be. And so after we were, you know, it was confirmed that it was Ewing's, and after we were going to start the chemo in a few days, we called each of the kids. Each was in some unbelievable new phase of their life. All right. One was starting the dream job in New York. One was in graduate school. And the other one was on a semester abroad in Cuba without cell coverage. And we had to reach out to all of them separately to explain how their unbelievably healthy dad was going to be going through this. One of the other things, if you have children, whether they're, it's probably appropriate for teenagers or adults who are very almost freaked out by the hospital experience, is there's actually a few things that they can participate in. So my oldest daughter came to the hospital and helped shave my head. You know, when my hair started falling out.
What a journey to get to the point where you finally found a diagnosis. You were in a great position of the fact that your wife had heard of sarcoma and already had some resources and some information about sarcoma. What would you recommend to people who are in a different situation that has, or may hear you're diagnosed with sarcoma? When you heard that, you have 5 days to get yourselves prepared for this journey. What did you guys do initially to get yourselves prepared?
It's a great question. So my wife, who was on Facebook, immediately went on the Ewing Sarcoma Facebook group and just researched everything, read everything. Who's getting what treatment? What are they getting? Are they on the pediatric or the adult protocol? She used to spend hours every night on the Ewing's Sarcoma Facebook. She now, unfortunately, spends hours every night on the relapsed Ewing's sarcoma group. But, you know, here's someone that one would think would know everything, and her journey only started with this crazy amount of research. She did reach out to the doctor she knew who had treated this for advice. She actually called up and met with all of the old nurses she worked with, like who remembered what on Ewing's. And then meanwhile, I had a friend who had leiomyosarcoma, and he was about a year ahead of me on the sarcoma journey. And we even had the same doctor. And so when he heard my situation, he immediately called me and said, let's meet before you go to the hospital on Tuesday. And he laid out for me, not the sarcoma things, but the survival in the hospital things.
Oh.
And to me, that was the most important, because there was nothing I could do about the sarcoma. There was nothing I could do about the treatment. I had no decisions to make, right? The treatment was given. If there was any options, my wife and the doctor discuss it to this day. But it was all sorts of spectacular advice. From when you get a double room, which at where we were was likely to happen, do we want to be by the door or the window? Why? What do you bring to the hospital? What do you wear when you're in the hospital? Why? All sorts of other tricks and advice. So what I typically do for friends who are starting any type of cancer or sarcoma journey, a lot of people call me, is I'm the advice person, typically on the non-medical things, but on like, how do you survive the hospital visit and the weeks in between?
I think that's such a great thing to offer to people who are stepping into a similar path that you've been on, because yes, you need the resources for the medical side, but what you're talking about here contributes a lot to your mental health and how you take this on and think about it. And you might not think a window versus the hallway side of the room matters, but when you are spending so much time at a hospital, what to wear, what to pack, you know, that's a mental load you actually have to take on. For our listeners, what are things you'd recommend they bring to the hospital, or how to get through those stays?
So, I went and bought 4 extra copies of my 2016 Boston Marathon hat, which I wear. And my sister sent me little head coverings that said Boston 26.2, because she knew well that I would be losing my hair very quickly. And that, so the trick for me was, I got dressed in quote unquote work clothes every day. In the morning, I got out of the nightgown and I put on blue jeans and a button down shirt. And when they weren't futzing with me, my wife and I would walk up and down the hall pushing the IV pole. And I would get miles of walking and steps in, going up and down, dressed, not in a gown, but in blue jeans with tennis shoes and a shirt. Like, and that just made me feel a little bit better. And then the most important thing to bring is a really long phone charger, because the plug is too far away from where your phone is. So long phone charger.
That's a really good one.
Yeah, I think we've heard that one too. It's interesting that you said you got up and walked miles every day. Exercise has played a very important role in your sarcoma journey. Can you talk about how it's helped you through your journey?
Yeah. So initially, I broke my collarbone. And within a few weeks, I was in the hospital. So I had a sling on for the first few weeks. And I walked with a sling. And that was about all I could do. And then halfway through the chemo treatment, they did a full clavectomy. They removed my collarbone. Thought they had clean margins. The tumor was, you know, in the 90% dead, which they thought was pretty good, not perfect. And then I continued the chemo process. But I still needed a sling for a while. However, before I was completely sling free, I could actually get on my Peloton on the weeks when I was not in the hospital and exercise. So I couldn't walk very fast. I certainly couldn't run, but I could Peloton. And I exercised through the whole thing, right, as if I was training pretty hard. And so I would work out on my Peloton and try to do the same time that I timed on the Peloton. But of course, the output was 40% less. And on fun days, I would actually do the math to say, well, if my hemoglobin had been 14 and not 10, you know, my output would have been. And then once the collarbone healed well enough, I started walking faster, and then I was able to start running again.
You tracked your hemoglobins and continued your exercise to the point of being able to run a marathon after 11 rounds of chemo, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so I finished the chemo in roughly the summer of 2018. And it's important to remind everybody, while it was a great goal to have me do the chemo every 2 weeks, my platelets didn't cooperate. And if your hemoglobin doesn't cooperate, they can give you lots of hemoglobin. And if your platelets don't cooperate, they can give you a little bit of platelets, but they can't give you very much. So what was 2 week cycle became 3 week cycle, and then became 4 week cycle. So we eventually decided that the slow recovery of the platelets was at risk to my life expectancy. And this is a call all the doctors have to make. So we made the call and we stopped the treatment after 11 rounds in the middle of the summer of 2018. And I was running by then, and I kept running, and I got faster and faster. And the joke was, you know, some of my elite runner friends spend a lot of money to go up to Aspen or Mammoth to train at high altitudes. If your hemoglobin's 10, you are effectively training at a high altitude, and it's just as good. And the hemoglobin comes back, and you're ready to go. And a friend of mine said, Dan, you should try to run another marathon. And in December of 2019, I ran my lifetime PR fastest marathon at 9.5, missing a collarbone.
Incredible.
And it felt great.
And that's should be noted, that was like your 7th marathons. Yes. So you're a seasoned marathon runner, which means you've done a lot of marathon training. And I'm curious if that training has crossed over into your sarcoma journey over the last 8 years. So marathon running takes a lot of dedication and mindset. So has that something that has transitioned into your mindset in your sarcoma journey?
Oh, I would say completely. Part of training to run is how hard you can push yourself. Mm-hmm. And part of good marathon training is, when do you take time off?
Mm,
and when do you not push yourself? And when do you take a break after the marathon? And as you get to be in your 50s, you know, how it's so important to have 2 days off a week from running and this kind of stuff. But almost all runners at some level have a running diary where they keep track of their runs and how fast they run and how it feels. So I put this on Excel about 15 years ago. And then I would add in, as I got older, did I do my stretches? Did I do my stretches on the off day? How I felt, so on and so forth. So back to your earlier question, when I started chemo, I had this Excel spreadsheet where I could track everything. So instead of saying how far I ran, I would say how well I felt. How did I sleep? Really important things about what I weighed going to bed and what I weighed in the morning. This is hugely important because sometimes when you get infusions, you get a huge amount of weight gain. And there have been times where the weight gain for me was just the drug. And there were times when the weight gain was higher than that and my lungs were filling up with fluid. And that was a warning sign that I needed to do something different. And then there were times where, you know, this particular anti-nausea med was better or caused this and that side effects. So in my Excel spreadsheet, I kept adding columns to like other things. How I felt. Did I have heartburn? Some of the chemos caused horrible heartburn, right? Some for a week, some for 2 days. When do you take which drugs to push that? So I basically turned the, not maniacal, engineering-based, running-based analysis into, you know, what really helped me here.
With the sarcoma journey.
So you mentioned one of the treatments that you've been on, but you sort of interwoven throughout your journey that you've been on several treatments. Can you talk about the treatments that you've been on?
I'm happy to do it. And it's obviously it up. So I started with what was, may still be, the standard first line of treatment for Ewing's. And the goal was 14 rounds of one treatment of ifosfamide and a etoposide, i.e., and then the subsequent visit would be CAV, Cytoxan, Adriamycin, Vincristin. So the i.e., CAV, and then you have to be very careful with the Adriamycin, because the Adriamycin has a lifetime limit. Because the Adriamycin can cause some heart issues. So I got an echocardiogram, and that's a very standard thing to do. And then we didn't talk about the next part. So I finished this marathon, was ready to run Boston when COVID hit. And late in 2020, in the early days of COVID, a routine PET scan picked up a couple of tumors in my shoulder area, which surprised everybody that I had it, because I had almost made the 3 years. This was actually the 3-year scan, if you start the 3-year, what I was diagnosed. And everyone said, but it's local, you're really lucky. So I had 6 rounds of irinotecan mixed with Timidor. That was all outpatient. In the middle of that, I had surgery to remove the tumors. And the surgeon was trying to be very careful about not having me lose shoulder function, because I know other people who have lost shoulder function, and was willing to make some decisions because we had also decided that we would radiate my whole shoulder. So I had not done the radiation before. And then we did the 30 days of full-on radiation. And then we finished with monthly rounds of Timidor for additional 6 months. So this whole thing took about a year. Now, because I didn't break a collarbone or have a clavectomy, I was able to literally run through the whole thing.
Wow.
And the radiation oncologist said, "You're running?" I go, "Yep." And we discussed how fast. And he said, "We just don't have any 60-year-olds. Right, who are doing this. So I think it's okay. But kind of keep doing it." So I got through that, finished up that in December of 21, and was all excited for running Boston in April of 22. Because of COVID, you were allowed to defer your golden ticket, the qualification to Boston. And I had just run a half marathon. The next week, I had done my 16-mile training run. And I thought, boy, my hemoglobin's still in the 12s. It's on its way to 14. I am running faster than I've ever run faster in my life. And my doctor called us with the results of the PET scan. On Valentine's Day 2022, and said, there's stuff in your lungs. I was like, it can't be, right? I feel so good. Everything's so good. And she said, we're not sure it's cancer, but it's likely cancer. And the only way we're going to find out is by doing a biopsy, you know, which was a wedge resection going into my lung. And of course, I joked about, can you wait for 8 weeks and give me an extra pint of blood so I could run the Boston Marathon? And she explained to me that because it has metastasized, it is stage four. And you need to work on this quickly. We got a call from another doctor at a major sarcoma center. And his comment was, you're healthy enough right now that now's the time to try some trials. And this was consistent with what our oncologist here had said. There was an interesting discussion about which trial to do. But they discussed the comment that once it's metastasized, it's very rare to get rid of. And that there's a lot you can do to hold it at bay. In the meantime, they did the full wedge resection. They took out multiple tumors. They confirmed quickly that it was Ewing's that had come back. And then we began the process of the trial. And this is a whole world unto itself. We fought hard in that this center was ready to do it, but hadn't yet started it. But we convinced them to move up the time frame, and another major sarcoma center. Now, this is the third one we've talked to, the one that we're dealing with, the one I got the call from, and this one. And this involved a plane flight, agreed to start me on a phase one trial.
When you were having those discussions, I'm certain, I have no doubt from hearing you talk, that you were presented with clinical trial options and you and your wife did some research on which ones you thought were best for you. Was there any hesitation and the discussions that you had or in your thought process about going into a phase 1-2 trial? And I bring that up because in sarcoma, there are a lot of phase 1-2 trials for therapies. And sometimes that makes people a little bit nervous. Did you have any hesitation about a phase 1 trial?
Huge hesitation and huge issues. It was completely new to us. So the actual decision that we were being asked to make was between a phase one trial that combined a new drug with a standard of care, some chemo agents, with the second one that was a brand new drug that looked really good. Both of them require travel. And we, in particular my wife, factored in quality of life issues. Right. I was blessed in, I've thrown up a few times on this journey, but I typically don't. The anti-emetic drugs, seem to work. We seem to know how to dial them up. And I'm a little nauseous, but I'm not miserable. So we had to make a decision between these two trials. And we went with the newer drug that didn't have the other line of treatment with it, but it was being tolerated well. Mm-hmm. And I tolerated really well. And after the first scan, there was some question about whether I still fell within the criteria because the tumor, depending on how you measured it, the tumors either grew or didn't grow. So after 2 months, the results looked kind of okay, so I stayed on trial. To such an extent that, you know, we did a fairly big trip. 5-hour plane flight, kind of fun, wife and I trip. Came back.
Dan, how long did you stay? So how, when you had to take the 5-hour plane flight, how often did you have to do that?
So sorry, the plane flight for the trial was only an hour.
Oh, okay.
Right. And I probably had to do that. I probably flew it 5 times and drove it 3 times. Oh. They first said the blood tests were every month, then it was every 2 weeks. My point was we felt so good that we were willing to go on a vacation that was 5 hours away, kind of away from major medical equipment. Mm-hmm. Came back, and in the meantime, they were collecting blood samples for a different phase 2 trial. So there was a whole class, people were very excited about it a few years ago, of can you find individuals with specific markers? In my case, the AXL, AXL protein. And people were looking, as they called it, pan cancer solutions. And this third major medical center that I was at said, well, you ought to take the blood test for it, but we're not finding anybody that has this AXL expression. But there's a great trial that we have that we're certain will work if you have the expression. And I remarkably had the numbers. Meantime, I had a giant flare-up of something in dramatic pain. And there was a debate between my local oncologist and this other group about what it was. But a PET scan confirmed that one of the tumors had just blown up in my lungs. And we needed to radiate it quickly. So we did the radiation on this tumor. This automatically removes me from trial 1. But I qualified for trial 2, and it turned out the trial was being opened at another major sarcoma center that was a reasonable drive from our house. So we signed up there for this phase 2 trial. It didn't do anything. There was clearly some tumor growth, and they started me immediately on gentamicin, which I don't pronounce very well. And we had 2 rounds of that, and the CT said, nothing's good here. You have a fast-growing tumor, and this was the low point of the whole cancer journey, because the oncologist said, if you really want to be at your daughter's wedding in March, you may want to move up that date. I had a terrible reaction to the gemtabicide, which I'm pronouncing wrong, like a massive reaction, whole team came running in. But eventually we decided that wasn't the drug, and we switched to Cytoxan topotecan. And the tumor started shrinking. And we spent the entire year or on Cytoxan topotecan. I had 20 rounds of that. The goal was every 3 weeks, but after things were looking good and tumors were shrinking, we went every 4 weeks. We sometimes did every 5 weeks if there was a vacation or a wedding or a graduation, and really had a good year. That was things removing. In the middle of it, though, we had an ablation. Now, for people who are on this podcast and don't know what an ablation is, ablation is a sort of technical term when you use some energy to blast away material. In the case of sarcoma or cancers, they will typically stick a needle in or near the tumor or the cancer, and either with radio frequency energy or with heat or with some cooling mechanism, try to blast away, kill the tumor. So there was a very exciting new potential ablation that in some of the early research was causing cell death in such a way that it might maybe, if you squint, produce an immune response to the cancers. So people were very excited about this particular type of ablation. My oncologist got me to be number one on the list to do this at the major medical center. Not wanting to be number one and wanting to go to one of my kids' graduations, I signed up to be number two and spent a lot of time. I have a very technical background. I read all the papers, had a delightful talk with the interventional radiologist that does this, and they did this particular ablation. Nothing. Didn't do anything. So the Cytoxan, topotecan continued. I'm now back running. I had various aches and pains. And then in the fall of, and then in January now of 24, we realized the tumors were growing, and we had to switch chemos. So when we were looking at our CT scans, we actually saw that the tumors were shrinking over time. The problem was on the PET scans, they were showing activity, avidity being the technical word. And this is what caused us to worry about them. And then eventually the CT started showing up. Interestingly, many of you may know or will have learned that you can often get the CDs of your scans. And most major sarcoma centers now actually let you look at the pictures of your scans online in your medical records, though they remove some of the functions from that. Like you can't measure them with the measuring tools. I used to measure all my tumors with the measuring tools.
Dan, just hearing you talk, that is not surprising to me.
Right. The joke was we not only measured them, we named them. In February of now 24, we decided that two of the tumors lent themselves to an old-fashioned radio frequency ablation. So we took a pause from the chemo and we ablated two of the tumors. That appeared to be wildly successful from killing the tumors, though I can't say it's related, but I never felt I fully recovered from that surgery. And a week later, I feel like I'm weighing more than I normally do with chemo. And 2 weeks later, they had me in the hospital for a pleuridesis, where they add some talc between the various linings of your lung after they have removed the fluid. And this is to prevent it from happening again. So I had the pleuridesis in my right lung. And then I went on. I also had two different rounds of radiation to try to zap some of the tumors. And then I had two rounds of the trabectedin, and I ended up in the hospital needing a pleuridesis on my left lung. So I got that, and there was a lot of imaging that went around there, and we decided that the trabectedin wasn't the right thing to do. So we decided I needed to do Yondalis with irinotecan. And then we're in about August of 2024. One of the PET scans said you now have, they use the term bony mets, but metastasis to your bones. And so we need to give you a different chemo. So they gave me Doxil. And along with Doxil, they gave me something called Xgeva, which is a bone density building shot that may also have some anti-cancer properties. So 2 months later, the next PET scan seems to show the Doxil is working from the bone side, but the lungs aren't good. So they added Doxil plus irinotecan. The next set of scans showed bony mets are back in the same place. So we decided, we switched. We've now run out of all the chemos. So we've gone back to the IE, the ifosfamide etoposide that we did 7.5 years ago. Because we really have run out of drugs that don't have terrible, terrible side effects. There's a few tricks left, but given my situation, would love not to lose feeling in my feet and stuff like that. A very interesting thing, because of the data keeping, we noticed that all of the PET scans were done right after, within like 5 days of the treatment. And this was done intentionally in the cycle, so we would have time for the radiologist to read it, the time to meet with the oncologist, the time to do some research, if you will, in order to decide what to do for the next chemo. But there was some worry that we were taking the PET scans, we were doing the PET scans while in the middle of taking the Neupogen shots. So for most people that have cancer, we learn that your white blood cell count collapses after chemo, and the miracle of Neupogen, under its different names, can help you build up that white blood cell count. And so we had the PET scan a week after the last Neupogen shot. And it showed no bone metastasis. And the radiologist who read it says the difference may be, in fact, because of the shots. So this is a little inside baseball for various people. It's a shout out to my wife on her good record keeping.
You bring up something here, which is the data keeping, and also how your wife has contributed to that. Being able to track all of these things on your own, you've then been able to bring that to your team and say, well, we should scan it this time. This is really a strength that the two of you have of tracking your treatments, your side effects, how you're feeling. How did the two of you work together on that?
Asha, it's a wonderful question. So she has come to every appointment, and she is a spectacular record keeper. And our advice to everybody is always try to have somebody else at the appointment, especially keeping records. As the patient, shocked by the new information, stunned by what to do, to have someone else keep the records. My wife keeps very detailed records about all of the cancer treatments, what amount was given, when, how long it took. She makes really copious notes during the treatment and during any of the doctor visits. And this has been spectacular when we go back and look at, did I have a reaction to a certain drug, and what did we do to change that or to fix that or this kind of stuff. So her record keeping kind of is the gold standard, but I remind everybody it is super helpful. My Excel spreadsheet is more about, when I got a treatment and how I felt afterwards and what I did. So in some ways, the two have really complemented each other. And then when she's on the Ewing Relapsed Facebook group, Relapsed, right? She's able to see what other people are doing. She could share a little bit. And it's become a great team effort. But again, it's our reminder to everybody, take good notes and have somebody else taking good notes.
I think that's a really key point because, as you mentioned, as the patient sitting there, you have so much information coming at you at once. You're just trying to process it all. But having someone else to say, and I know this was helpful for me when I was helping my parents, somebody's got to be there listening and taking the notes. But we also found we all heard different things. And so when you're comparing notes, it makes it much easier to remember everything that happened within the appointment and the discussion.
Brandy, it's a really good point. My wife is a pediatric nurse, and I call her the gold standard of note-taking, right? And I went to meetings as like a living for 30 years and prided myself on remembering what happens and also taking good notes. And absolutely, you tell the story. There are times where we say, what did that doctor say at this point in time? And we come up with two different answers.
It's also interesting the way you both took notes and were able to collaborate, because it sounds like you were able to not only make decisions about treatments, but also about your quality of life. When you knew, if I get this chemotherapy within 3 days, I'm going to get nauseous. So let's start taking the nausea medicine. You were really able to focus also on your quality of life throughout the journey.
Absolutely. And once you're told it's stage 4, right, then you get to ask yourself a completely different set of questions about quality of life, right? What does it mean? And so kind of knowing what chemos do what to you or other people and what drugs you can take as a side effect are key things. We actually have a joke. Whenever you go into your appointments, and however many appointments I have, it seems like half my life is going to appointments, they ask you how nauseous you are. And I always say, like, well, that's a 3 or 4. And my wife says, that's a Dan Rubin 3 or 4. Like, most right. people are like at a 7 or 8. And I go, well, if you're not throwing up, it's not a 10. And the end of the Boston Marathon's like a 9, and you get a D rate from there. It's really a joke, and it's really a reminder to everybody to sort of keep track on whatever your scale is. So you can kind of know what extra meds you need. I'd like to also add, I think it is really important for people going through the journey, is when I see the in between medical visit times, you got to be really careful, right? How often do you go get a blood test? The major sarcoma centers are really good when you go visit the nurses, and they're really good when you go visit the doctors, but often things can fall through the cracks, you know. How many Neupogen shots do you need, days worth of Neupogen shots do you need for this new chemo? And how do you know, and how often do you have to get your blood test? So part of the data tracking is to kind of let us know when we have to notify them.
Right. You've learned so much over the last 8 years from your personal experience and also from the data that you've tracked. And something new that you've learned about is palliative care and what that means. After, you know, 8 years of all of the treatments you've just described, could you talk a little bit about the palliative care you're receiving now and what that actually means?
Right. So as people will know, sometimes along with cancer goes some level of pain. And as I started to have various pains in my lungs, we started trying to figure out what were the right drugs. And then eventually we talked to a palliative care team. I didn't know what the word meant. I thought it was equivalent to hospice. Now I sort of panicked over this, right? When palliative means how do you keep the pain down? Now where my situation is unlikely to get better, we have to make decisions about some of the treatment I'm getting is really palliative. And, you know, what decisions do you make around trying to minimize pain, plus quality of life, plus trying to kill whatever tumors you can to live as long as possible?
You know, you mentioned using your data tracker. I know we keep talking about this data tracker, but I think it's a wonderful tool. I think important for people to understand how important that is. And everyone has different mechanisms. Some people use Excel spreadsheets, some people use apps. It's whatever system works best for them. But importantly, the data that you tracked, and what you said was, it was important because sometimes you'd have to remind them of things you might need, or maybe it's time for this. And that is true patient involvement and self-advocacy. And that's also where the care partner comes in. And in helping the patient who's maybe sick at the time, maybe just dealing with whatever treatment they're on and getting through that, but helping to keep track of all the things so that nothing is missed. And so there's so many benefits. You've used this data collection and your tracker and your Weiss copious notes for so many different ways throughout your journey, which trials or which treatments or how that treatment might affect you, to be able to make decisions about your journey. And I think that's an important message for people to get out of this particular episode of this podcast is whatever works for you, but there's multiple ways to collect that data. And sometimes when you think that it might not be useful, it can come into play in so many different ways.
Randy, absolutely wonderful point. Yes, and we have found not one time has a nurse, an oncologist, a surgeon, a nurse practitioner been offended when we have said, boy, here's this data. Maybe we should do this slightly differently, or what do you think given that this is the anomaly or not? And so we have found that all of the care providers, right, have appreciated the fact that we're tracking this stuff and have comments. So like if anyone's afraid of the self-advocacy and, oh, I don't know what the doctors know, Brandy, your point is a really, really important one.
That's a great message, Dan, because it can be very intimidating for patients to advocate for themselves. And I think that really just drives the message home that by participating in your care in this way, you help them help you. And you work as a team to move your care forward. That's really important.
Right. And if you're advocating for a treatment you read about on Google, that's one thing,
right,
which I highly recommend you don't do. If you are advocating for yourself based on a slight modification of what's happening based on the data that you've collected that the hospital doesn't have, that wasn't in the blood test, that wasn't in the last visit notes, everybody's going to listen to that. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, we do find that the medical professionals do appreciate that because it also helps them to make decisions. They want to make the best decision for their patients. And maybe they don't have all the information that you're tracking because only you can track that at home. And even in trials, I know there's quality of life measures, but that doesn't track the whole journey. If you're in a trial, side effects can be different for each person. So while a doctor could say to you, well, we've seen these side effects, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to see them. But if you do, it's interesting to be able to track how these things impact you in particular, and the doctor won't necessarily be able to capture that information.
It's as simple as I'm having the following stomach problems, and I've tried the following 10 things, and they go, oh yeah, this 11th thing might be useful to go try. You're not really showing off the data. You are simply saying, gosh, here's what we've tried. Help us.
You are so right. It's interesting because we often see, too, that patients will get off of a trial or get off of a treatment because of the side effects that might be able to be managed if they were just having that conversation. So as you said, we've tried these 10 things. Do you have anything else? And then it spurs the medical professional to say, okay, well, here's something else we might be able to try that supports the patient, improves their quality of life, but also really helps with treatment adherence, which could potentially improve the outcome. So it is definitely a shared decision-making process, and understanding that it's a collaborative effort and everybody's in this together, that communication becomes so important. We've weaved throughout this whole discussion your exercise and being on a Peloton and running and walking when you had to walk. Where are you now with your exercise? Because we would love to see you join one of our Race Secure Sarcoma Marathon teams one day.
When I first was told that I might have metastasis to the bones, the doctor said, don't run anymore. But my lung capacity from the 6 lung surgeries plus ablation is way low. And you add that into the low hemoglobin. I don't know that I'm running again. I did have a very bad January and February with a lot of pain and didn't exercise much through that. I found that after chemo, I could get on the Peloton and exercise or run. I would come home from the hospital and I would run or Peloton. I didn't feel very good doing it, but I could do it and I felt better afterwards. And there is a totally minority theory. Don't put this in any science books, from a researcher I talked to who had multiple rounds of cancer. You know, why does exercise and may give you a better outcome with cancer? It says maybe if you're exercising hard enough, you're pushing the chemo to the smallest capillaries in your body. There's no good science around that, but it makes me feel good when I push the chemo to the smallest capillaries in my body.
You know, there's another theory, Dan, that I think is something to consider is it's also about mental, right? It sounds to me like exercise was also very therapeutic for you. And we know in the mental health space that exercise is good for mental health. And so when you're going through something like this, we do know that mental health is part of quality of life and it helps you through your journey. So it could have also been that exercise was very therapeutic for you to keep that mindset and to be able to continue to move forward through so many tough treatments through such a long journey.
Oh, Brandy, it is much more likely that than it is the pushing the chemo to the smallest capillaries. I would completely agree with you. So my situation is I had tremendous issues with pain in December and January. And I stopped exercising a lot. I walked a little bit. And we seem to have solved the problems that were causing the pain. Certain drugs that we were getting to counteract things might have been causing that pain. So I have been feeling better and better and better over the last 2 weeks. But it's like starting back running after you haven't run. So like, a mile and a half walk with a hill was really hard. And then I did 2 miles. And then last weekend, I did 3.5 miles with my wife. Right? And I felt really good about it. And then I'm on the Peloton getting my heart rate higher. So it's like I have to know not to compare my Peloton output this morning to what I did when I didn't have cancer, but to what I didn't do a month ago. And so I am building back slowly. Brandy, to answer your specific question, I am unlikely to run a marathon. My daughter was in the sarcoma team and training for the Boston Marathon when it got canceled by COVID. We did participate in the San Francisco sarcoma 5K. And you get a different color shirt whether you're a supporter, and a yellow shirt if you're an active patient. So my wife got me an active patient shirt, and I was the only person that ran it with a yellow shirt.
Which that's amazing. Yeah,
meant that I easily won the category of active patients because I was running it. And this is now almost 2 years ago when I was still running pretty well. And I was dangerously close to winning the over 60s.
That's amazing. You also participate in Seattle and Boston under your team. So you set up your own team with a very unique name. Can you talk about your team name and the meaning behind it?
Was it Run Towards It?
Yes.
It's really hard. This is a hard one, and I don't know that it makes sense to other people. But my daughter, who was living in Boston, got a team to run the sarcoma race in Boston. And my son was in Seattle at the time. And before I was diagnosed, there had been a series of terrorist attacks. And there's always a question about what you're supposed to do in a terrorist attack. And my kids have been taught, you know, run if you can. If you can't run, hide. And if you can't hide, then fight. And my view was, I've had a blessed life, right? Maybe you should just run towards the shooter. And if two people run towards the shooter, you might just be able to stop it. It was a comment that was made almost in jest. And when my wife brought me for the first cancer treatment, and we were walking down the hall, I told her I didn't think this was the way I was going to die. I thought maybe it was going to be running towards a shooter. And she said, well, why don't we just let that be our motto? And so that became the motto of Run Towards It. I really don't like the shooting analogy as much as I like, you might as well run towards the obstacle in your life. And if you're going to deal with these obstacles, rather than hiding from it, rather than running from it, you can just run towards them. So that is how we got the name of the team.
I love that name, and you're so right. And I have to say, my brother was a Ranger in the military, and also when he got out of the military, he was also worked in intelligence for our government. And that is something he used to say to me all the time. You don't run from the fire, you run towards it. And that was a mantra that he had learned as well, and that was a motto for his life. So you're right, it's obstacles. And maybe it's the shooting analogy isn't the right one because it does fit your entire life. And especially, Dan, your sarcoma journey. And one thing I do want to say is this discussion today, there is no doubt in my mind through this journey and whatever the wherever this journey takes you, you are definitely going to run towards it.
So along the lines of run towards it, one of the things that I almost always did is while you're waiting for your treatment, and there's a lot of sick people, hopefully wearing masks, sitting around, they would call my name, and I would run down the hall towards the nursing assistant. And this was part of the run towards it. Now that I've been told I shouldn't run anymore, I sometimes walk quickly, wave, do some other stunt. But anyways, I do. That is one of my stunts as I run down the hall.
I love that story.
Everyone
laughs. Yeah.
I have to be careful not to hit people.
That's funny.
Fastest guy in the clinic.
Yeah, fastest guy in the clinic. That's right. You can take that one home too, Dan. You're the fastest guy in the clinic.
There were times when I would walk up and down the corridors when I had my first treatment. I would run into other patients who were walking. And I'd always say, you want a race?
That's fun. I'm sure it brightened people's days as well as yours, but I'm sure it brightened people's days as well.
One of the other stunts is when you check in at the cancer center, instead of saying, I'm Dan Rubin here for my treatment, I have been known to say, I'm Dan Rubin checking in for the flight to London.
Oh, that's a good one.
And some of the receptionists play along. And then the next line is, and we would love first class seats, but my wife understands that because I'm the sick one, if you only have one first class seat, she will let me sit up there.
That's right. She'll sit in the back, no problem.
Had a great sense of humor, that's for sure.
That's one of Dad's bits, as the kids call it when they visit with me.
Dan, there are so many parallels that you could draw between your running and your marathon training and your treatment. And I'm curious how you would describe your mindset, because it seems like in both your running journey and your treatment journey, there are good days and there are hard days, and you can't compare between the two. But how do you remain optimistic on the hard days?
There's really two things. My wife and I sat down once a few months into the journey to talk about how lucky we were that we actually live close to a sarcoma center, that she knew this space, that I went into it healthy, that the kids were older. And we decided to focus on whenever you have the bad moment and say, why me, is to focus on the good things. So that's one. The second one was a very bright friend of mine sat me down just before I had my first chemo treatment. And he said, Dan, knowing you, you're going to be optimistic 95% of the time. And 5% of the time, you'll be very, very depressed. And it will probably be in the middle of the night. And you should know that that's both okay and normal. And that was so helpful to me to understand that, you know, sometime is just bad. Now, the joke is I got it to 98%, 98% optimistic, 2% bad. And then I was talking to a friend saying, I was trying to get it higher than that, but it's just not worth the effort.
So the running and the exercise was so therapeutic for you, Dan. It was like an outlet for you. And now where do you find that outlet?
I would say I still find joy from it. And I say, well, instead of spending 2 hours running in the mountains with an hour worth of prep and some driving and back, I now can get all the exercise done in 20 minutes on the Peloton. It is a more efficient use of my joy. And I miss terribly running with my friends in the hills. But I can get the Peloton done quickly. So I walk with my friend, my main running friend. We still try once a week, once every 2 weeks to walk. And if that's, he comes over to my house and brings sandwiches and we walk a mile around my house because that's all I could do last month, right? Or we walk 3 miles somewhere. That's still more efficient than 2 hours running in the mountains.
It's like that saying, if you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. You're adapting what has brought you joy with where you are currently.
People may not be old enough to get the following reference, but Sandy Koufax was one of the great pitchers of all times. And he used to pitch in the Dodger old-timer games as like a curiosity for fans who came sometimes. And Vince Scully, who was the announcer for the Dodgers for 60 years, was once calling the Dodgers old-timer game. And he said, Sandy Koufax is on the mound and throwing as hard as ever. The ball is just taking a lot longer to get to the plate.
All right. That's fantastic.
And so when I Peloton this morning, I did as much as I could. Why? I know how long it takes for my heart rate, how many minutes it takes for it to get back down to normal. And that's the thing that go check over time. And there wasn't any more left this morning. Right. Unfortunately, it wasn't very much. And it was only 20 minutes. But I felt great having done it. And so I think, look, the running mantra is as you get older, you have to reset all your goals anyways. And when you have whatever situation hits you, you know, a new sarcoma diagnosis, you have to reset all of those expectations. I mean, I was somebody who slept 5 hours a night. I drank 5 cups of coffee. I got phenomenal amount of stuff done before the kids got up. I could drive the kids to school, play with the kids, stay up late and do everything. And now I have to sleep 9 or 10 hours a night, and I have to build in a nap every day. So I'm doing a lot less, and I have to completely reset my expectations about what I can do. Mm-hmm. I would add one more thing, which is don't be afraid to ask your friends for help.
That's a good one.
It's been very hard for me because I've been blessed with a wife who can do a remarkable number of things. And I'm pretty good most of the time. You know, if I'm not on active chemo, I can drive. And I just have a lot of friends that really want to help. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to say, all right, drive me to the hospital one day. Or, you know, there's this project at home that I just never got done because I'm now sleeping 10 hours a day. Can you come help me for half an hour?
That's great advice. Dan, do you have any final message you want to leave with our listeners on the podcast today?
I do have one more thing. I have found that it's not only a thing that makes the world better and makes me feel better to thank all of the people on the journey. Mm. I thank the nurses. I thank the nursing assistants. I thank the housekeepers who are cleaning the bathroom ahead of me or the bed afterwards. I thank the receptionists who know me by name, by look. I don't have to say anything when I go up to the reception counter. And I have found it not only makes the world a better place, it's just an easier way to deal with like the fact that I got a diagnosis that sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The world is an infinitely better place, Dan, with you existing in it. So thank you for sharing that.
And the only other thing to say, and my wife said, don't say it. Don't talk about how fast your marathon was. Right? It was a 3:32, right? At 59 and a half after treatment. So my kids have often joked that I can no longer win the age categories in the various 5K half marathon marathons I run, but I can certainly win the category of the person with the most rounds of chemo. So I am constantly winning and constantly won those particular categories. So my kids continue to create new categories.
It's all about how you frame it, I guess.
That's what I was going to say. It's all about perspective.
I have one final question, Dan, that we always ask because community is so important in the sarcoma world. And I know it's a very isolating diagnosis. So if anybody wanted to connect with you after this podcast, where could they find you?
Right. They can find me on LinkedIn. I am not the only Dan Rubin on LinkedIn, but I'm the only Dan Rubin who's been a venture capitalist.
We can link it in the show notes.
You can find my wife, Catherine Rubin, on the Relapsed Ewing Sarcoma Facebook group.
And we'll link to those, the Facebook groups that you mentioned.
Yeah, make sure that first one really exists because she spends all her time on the second one. So I'm assuming the first one exists.
Dan, you have another place where people can find you and connect with you, and it's your blog. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I kind of wanted to write about my cancer journey and I was struggling with it. And the kids felt that there was enough interesting material that I should actually do a blog. So I have a blog on Substack. It is called Running Without a Collarbone.
Which we will link to. Yep.
But you can find it on search Running Without a Collarbone on Substack. And I have multiple entries where I talk about my cancer journey in some level of detail, but because that might be too sad, I pair each of those stories with some crazy long run I did in a foreign city that I remember and often have pictures of.
Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciated this time with you.
Thank you so much for this conversation. We so appreciate everything that you've contributed to share with the community and your willingness to share your journey. So thank you for being here with us today. Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.